paper competition, which ran until Thursday morning, resulting in the winner and two runners-up from the Rowett and the Mordun, coming top of really excellent papers by a group of students from all the different institutes, all of whom had won their own competition. So truly a very high quality field in a penalty shootout, and somebody has to win, I guess, but they were all winners. That took a lot of organising. We had the Science for Life lecture yesterday afternoon by Professor Bob Watson from DEFRA. That's an annual lecture held between the institutes and the Royal Botanic Gardens Edinburgh and the Royal Society of Edinburgh. And this year it was our turn. We've had a number of dinners. And then, of course, today we have the exhibits and lunch and now this lecture. So a lot of people have been involved. And I'd like to thank some of them. It's a huge long list. It's going to be like reading the credits for the Lord of the Rings. So the staff reunion was organised by Lynn and Moira, Kay and Carol, and it was very much appreciated by all the people who visited. The student festivals, Pete Millard, Babel and Stuart Rind. You've seen the exhibits and displays. The graphics group, David, Pat, Barry and John, have done an excellent job there, and helped by other people looking after posters like Jay Morris, Dick Burney and others, and of course all the scientists who contributed work to those posters. This is a chance for us to look at what each other does in the work during the year. We've got flowers that Lynn and Lorraine arranged. We have a whole variety of people that are working on other things over a much, much longer time. Those of you who've been here in the last 8 weeks will have seen the mud bath that's been outside as we've prepared the grounds and done some landscaping, and technical services have been quite exceptional through all that. Now, the technical services is a very big group, so I won't go through all their names, but we do recognise what you've done on the grounds, on the building, and in making this a success as well through dealing with the issues of turfing and large areas of mud that looked like Wimbledon centre court for a while with tarpaulins and rain. The place is all been tidied up and kept clean, of course. We have people meeting you at reception. We have a Kaylee tonight, and we have two other people I would like to mention. But in thanking them, I'm thanking everybody who's been involved, and that's Jane Lund and Graham Gaskin, who manage these events and the technical services in quite exceptional style. So thanks to all of them. Perhaps you could join me in giving them a round of applause. This year, I want to take just a couple of minutes to talk about two other people, though. I don't know if you remember 1963. Steam trains still ran to Aberdeen. Aberdeen finished sixth in the Scottish First Division, so they've improved. that was the year that the size of the North Sea oil first began to be realised, but it was 6 years before the Forties field opened up. The Macaulay Institute was here, and it was 33 years old. There was also hill farming in Edinburgh. And on the 3rd of June 1963, just a few days ago, but years ago, Eileen Coburn started working at the Macaulay Institute. And she's retired this year after 45 years. Eileen had various jobs. She started off as a copy typist. Then she moved on to a sheet typist. I guess she'd be a word processor typist now, I suspect, if she was starting again, and I don't think she wants to. then she became a clerical officer, senior clerical officer. Then she played ping pong with the banding scheme, going band 7, then 6, then 7, then 6, and finished up as a band 5. That, to me, is quite an exceptional length of service. Eileen worked here for a huge time. She saw lots of change, and she's, as you know, customarily shy. She's not here. We are going to give her an engraved quake in recognition of it. She had a fairly quiet leaving party. But I think it is worth recognising in front of the staff and our visitors and friends what Eileen has done over such a long time. I can't think that there'll be many people these days who start on a career in one place that lasts that long. So our thanks to Eileen and a long and happy retirement. She's actually off to Houston next week. Oil's now in her blood, I guess. And she's going to see Margaret Forsyth for a few weeks. So thanks to Eileen in her absence, and we will be giving her a quake at some point. The second person is someone who is still at the Institute, who is known to all of us, and I would like to use this opportunity to recognise formally something quite exciting that happened to him this year. Steve Alban is known for his research on population ecology of ungulates, in particular red deer on Rum and Soy sheep on St Kilda. He also works on reindeer in Svalbard in Norway. And this year he was elected Fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. And to mark that as an institute on the board and everybody's behalf, we have a quake engraved for him. So I think this is a surprise to Steve, who's dressed in his smart clothes, so he can have his photo taken. I'd like him to come and accept this with our congratulations. Enough of me, our speaker. Mark Shucksmith, really, what did I say? What did I nearly say? I hope it was nearly. There's a tape, probably, so you'll all be listening to this one, and everyone will be checking the DVD out. Mark is a professor of planning at Newcastle University, but he's known to many of us from his time as professor of land economy and director of the Arkleton Centre for Rural Development Research at the University of Aberdeen. We're delighted to have him back here today. For those who don't know him, he's the first vice president of the international. He was the first vice president of the International Rural Sociological Association between 2004 and now. So you still are,
yeah.
Till next month. He was program chair for the 11th World Rural Sociology Congress in Norway, and the sociology word will give you an indication of his interests. His interests are in rural housing, social exclusion in rural areas, and rural development. He's written a number of books. And he's recently completed being chair of the Committee of Inquiry on Crofting for the Scottish Government, and the report for that was presented on May the 12th this year. Very interesting reading. You will see about it in the paper. You will see more about it as it's debated and discussed. And it's my pleasure to ask Mark to give us his lecture. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Richard, and thank you to everybody for inviting me here today. It's my first time back in Aberdeen since I left the university, so I'm very, very pleased to be back. I've worked with many of the people at the Macaulay over many, many years, and people that I've worked with include people like Jeff Maxwell, Maggie Gill, and Dick Burney in particular, and Deb Roberts and others who were at the university and are now here, and vice versa. And it's wonderful to see so many friends. I was going to say old friends, but actually young friends as well. It's very nice to be back. Thank you. I'm going to lecture on the subject today of, does the idea of integrated rural development still have any place in Scotland? The reason for adopting this title stems from the recent OECD review of rural policy in Scotland, which called for a more integrated approach across the Scottish Government in relation to rural policy. In its report, which if you haven't seen it, it's an excellent report, I recommend it, it talks about the rural policy in Scotland being extremely centralised compared to other countries. It talks about a very strong sectoral bias towards agriculture and the environment, and it talks about how the heterogeneity and diversity of rural Scotland is not well reflected in policy. And at the end of the report, what they recommend is that the Scottish approach to rural policy should evolve towards a more integrated one, capable of achieving coherence among sectoral policies while involving a wider set of stakeholders in policy design and implementation. And policy delivery should also be streamlined and spatially differentiated to meet the different needs and opportunities of Scottish rural regions. So the message that more integration is required comes out quite strongly from that. But what does that actually mean? And there is a phrase which has been used for around about 50 years now, integrated rural development. So I want to ask today what that means, and I'll start by looking at what it used to mean, and I'm going to suggest that it might mean something different now, and suggest the ways of trying to work out how to do integrated rural development in the 21st century. So my outline is, first of all, a brief history. Then I'm going to ask what rural development might mean in this much more complicated world that we have today, which has been described by one author, Mark Goodwin, as a nobody in charge world, which I think probably sums it up quite well. If you ask the Prime Minister, that's probably how he might see it at the moment. I'm going to make a brief excursion. You heard Richard say that I'm now a professor of planning, so I'm going to make a brief excursion into planning to look at this concept of place shaping and how reconceiving spatial planning in sort of planning theory might help us think about what integrated rural development might mean in the 21st century. This will lead us on a journey towards probably the hardest set of words that I'm going to throw at you today, which is neo-endogenous rural development. I'll try and leave you all with an understanding of what that might mean. I'll look at the potential that there is for this through LEADER, and I'll explain that too. And I'll end up with trying to illustrate the ideas that I put forward in terms of what we've recommended in the inquiry and crofting. So that's roughly where I hope we'll go. So first of all, integrated rural development, a potted history. And integrated rural development originated really in developing countries in the 1960s and the 1970s, and then was adopted and applied in the 1980s in Europe. And organisations like the Arkleton Trust were important in doing that, in building those dialogues where we could learn from the experience in developing countries. And one of the themes of that sort of approach in the 1980s, particularly in the way in which the European Commission designated pilot areas for integrated rural development, one of which was the Western Isles of Scotland, one of the main purposes of that was to experiment with moving away from a sectoral approach where agricultural policy was about agriculture towards an idea of rural policy, where what we were thinking about were territories and places rather than particular sectors. That's a whole lecture in itself, so I'll move over that very quickly. But one of the things that came out of that approach and its development in those pilot studies by the early 1990s was the LEADER Action Programme, which was a European Commission pilot programme. It's still a pilot programme. We're still supposed to be learning from it. And it was based around the idea that you could apply a territorial approach where people within a particular place thought about what they had in terms of their resources, the strengths and the weaknesses, the opportunities, the threats, and they could try and imagine what the future might be, what they would like the future to be for that place, and work together to try and achieve that with the help of government and other stakeholders and the European Union. It was characterised very much as a bottom-up local process, and indeed the original terms of the LEADER initiative talked about the territorial basis, a programming approach, and the incorporation of local knowledge which would help to avoid diagnostic errors. maybe not the words that we usually use to talk about bottom-up community development, but nevertheless capturing the essence of it, I guess. Now, LEADER has acquired since then a great symbolic importance and has offered many hopeful lessons. But it is far from an earlier understanding of a fully comprehensive integration and coordination of policies, programmes and actions amongst the various arms of the state and its partners. Because up until then, integrated rural development was very much seen as a means of bringing together the different silos of sectoral policies at the local level through the local authority, through coordination at the municipal level and through the local authority. Now, one of the reasons why it's so different, and why integrated rural development can't be understood in that simple way of the silos and pipelines of funding all being integrated by local authorities at the local level, is because the world has changed considerably. So this is why I'm coming to this question of what meaning now does integrated rural development have in the context of the 21st century if it no longer means bringing together these silos and pipelines of funding through local authorities. And to look at what it might mean, we have to look at re-theorisation of what government and governance are. And so I'm going to take you now on to the new rural governance. I understand you heard a lot yesterday about governance in the lecture, so you may already be familiar with this. Because instead, the term integrated rural development is called into question by a widespread recognition of a shift from government, by which is meant the state sponsorship of economic and social programmes, towards governance, which reflects the fact that the state can actually no longer control in that sort of way, and the fact of this, if you like, nobody in charge world. And I've tried to summarise on the slide here some of the main elements of the literature regarding governance as opposed to government. But obviously this is a very superficial and quick description of it. The first point to note is that the public sector can't do it on its own. The state can't do it on its own. The state increasingly is acting in partnership with the private sector and the voluntary sector. And indeed the boundaries between and within the public and private sectors have become very blurred. The second feature is that the state, instead of acting as provider, is increasingly acting as an enabler, trying to get other people to do what it wants to do rather than doing it itself. So there's that enabling rather than providing role, which is absolutely fundamental. What characterises this new modus operandi are tangled hierarchies, flexible alliances and networks, as Mark Goodwin put it, through which to govern. Often to the confusion of ordinary citizens who can't tell any longer who's in charge of what, and you have the nobody in charge world that I've spoken about. Often this new rural governance emphasises a discourse of local participation or community empowerment, and there's much talk of that at the moment. But in practice, alongside this local empowerment, local participation, there's a reliance on a set of managerial technologies which ensure that central government maintains control. And the sort of technologies I'm talking about here are performance targets, indicators, auditing and financial controls, which set the rules and set the parameters within which lower levels in the hierarchy have to work. So these managerial technologies ensure central control, even though local participation and local empowerment are espoused. I'm not speaking specifically about Scotland here. This is a developed worldwide literature. And you have then this phenomenon of government at a distance, where the government essentially is appearing not to be in charge, but actually is retaining control in these ways. One of my former colleagues from the university, Danny McKinnon, from the Geography Department, wrote a very interesting paper about how this applies within the Highlands and Islands, for example. I guess the other most important aspect of this new approach, this changed approach, is about power, because immediately you can see we're getting into talking about power relations. Who holds the power? Is it the central state or local communities? And the question of power is re-theorised in this approach to go away from an idea of authoritarian power, that is power over, sort of social control, towards this sort of enabling role where the state might be trying to build power in a sort of social production, a sort of generative way, in order to give communities power to do something. So there's a different aspect to power. Instead of power over communities, it's trying to give communities power to do things. And this is very much bound up with capacity building, which is a theme that I'll be returning to as we go on. Now, there's a lot been written about the effectiveness or otherwise of these new styles of government, a lot of literature on, you know, what makes a good partnership, whether partnerships are a good thing or not, how to deal with this complexity, where is the accountability, who's included and who's excluded in these processes, and at what scale they operate. Because one of the confusing things about all this is that these are all multi-scalar processes and they're all multi-scalar levels of governance which have to interact with one another. So it can be very, very difficult. And there are different ways of seeing it. Those who see the glass half full talk about this as participation and empowerment, whereas those who see the glass half empty perhaps talk about the state abdicating its responsibilities. And to an extent, both are true. It's a matter of which you give priority to. So having sketched out this sort of theorization that the political scientists and others give us of, you know, the changed world and how we govern in the changed world of the 21st century, what might integrated rural development mean in this new context? I hope you can already see that the old understanding of sort of silos of pipelines and all that being brought together by local authorities doesn't fit this anymore. The local authorities don't have the power they used to have, and the world is just more complicated. So to help us here, this is where I make an excursion into planning. I've said I'm now in a planning department, so it's been one of the very interesting aspects of working with my new colleagues. And planning, of course, has often been thought to be about integration. Other people see planning in perhaps a less charitable way. One of my former colleagues in Aberdeen, Phil Almendinger, who's now a professor at Reading, has written about how planning exemplifies government rather than governance. How planning, in his words, is the last vestige of the 1940s top-down approach. And somewhere else he's called it a modernist project in postmodern times. However, with the shift towards governance, away from government, planning too has been changed and has been reconceptualized. Refreshed and reinvented, and it's this changing understanding of it which helps us, I think, with understanding how integrated rural development as a concept might be changing and might have to change. One of my new colleagues, Patsy Healy, has made her reputation worldwide through writing about the reconception of planning and spatial planning in particular. And the essence of her many books and articles, boiled down into six bullet points here, at great violence to her, I will try and summarise for you. And the first thing to say is that place is conceived differently. Instead of seeing places in a sort of as given, if you like, you know, urban places, rural places, Aberdeenshire, Northumberland, place is now thought of as something which is socially constructed, always contested and continually co-produced. So our understanding of rural is something which we ourselves collectively have constructed and can be changed and can be thought about. Similarly with Aberdeenshire. The way it sees space is very different as well, because instead of seeing space in a sort of Euclidean distance way, which is actually very easy for us, space is seen in a much more complicated way, in relational terms. So the place that you're nearest to is not necessarily the place which is just down the road. It might be the place that you have all your research links with, or where you get your funding from, or where your markets are if you're an entrepreneur, where your customers are. So relational space is very different from the sort of Euclidean space that is much more about physical proximity. And this is something which is changing daily as we go through the technological changes of the global economy and the connected world. Development is seen differently. Instead of seeing development as a sort of linear progression, things always get a bit better and a bit better and a bit better, instead development is seen as something which is multiple, non-linear, continually emergent trajectories, where there are always many possibilities and much contestation of those. The context, of course, I've already suggested this a moment ago, is that of the network society and of multi-scalar governance in the way that I have tried to set out. Again, in this literature, in this planning literature, institutional relations are now seen not as authoritative, as power over, but as generative, as power to, trying to build the capacity of citizens themselves to produce these, to make the most of these emergent possibilities and to innovate. And the role of planners clearly changes if you understand planning in this way, because instead of planning being mainly about exercising regulatory power on behalf of the constituents and councillors, the role of planners becomes one of facilitating deliberative place shaping, by which I mean helping the people in a particular place to imagine their future and to try and think how to get there with the support of all the different stakeholders and participants. Essentially what I was talking about integrated rural development perhaps becoming. So under this paradigm, the function of strategic plans also changes. It's no longer to direct the state's investment using authoritative power, but the function of plans themselves is to exercise generative power to stimulate action, innovation, and to release potentialities. This idea of place shaping. Now, the key issues in place shaping, according to Patsy Healy, are two. They're no longer essentially technical issues. Planners are no longer seen in this reconception as essentially following a technical approach of planning. Their key tasks become, first of all, to mobilise actors to develop strategic agendas collaboratively and inclusively in these contexts where power is very diffuse, where nobody's in charge. So it's a very different set of skills, a very different culture. How do you bring people together to develop these strategic agendas in this sort of inclusive, collaborative way? And the second main challenge is how to think through concepts of place and space. How do you imagine your place and its future and what its strengths and relationships to other places are? And how do you think about space in this new way of not being, you know, the hinterland and the nearest market town, but the much more complex networked world in which we now live? And those are considerable challenges, cultural challenges to all the people involved, planners not least of all. So it's very much about political mobilisation as much as it's about planning techniques. Of course, there are tensions in this between what I've tried to sketch out here as the state's role in this enabling and entrepreneurial generative way and its regulatory role. Clearly, if you think about the countryside, that's very apparent, because on the one hand, you have all sorts of cultures and policies which try and prevent things happening there, in the name of, you know, keeping it free of houses and free of work and all the things that might be central to development and to the future of these places. And yet, if you're going to adopt an approach which is trying to make things happen and support innovation and strong rural economies, you've somehow got to try and do that at the same time as trying to keep national parks looking as they should and protecting landscape and biodiversity. So there is a tension, a fundamental tension, in the state's role here in this new world. Now, one of the ways in which to try and manage that is with what I said at the beginning would be the most frightening phrase this neo-endogenous rural development. And just to try and explain that very simply, endogenous rural development, endogenous is from within. So endogenous rural development is the idea that the people within a place themselves will have the ideas and the control, and many people thought that's what LEADER was supposed to be about. In practice, that can never happen, because there are always legitimate interests at higher levels, regions, national, global interests. And clearly, a lot of power is held at those levels. A lot of the funds, a lot of the decisions are made at those levels. So it's quite unrealistic, the idea of endogenous rural development. In practice, the best you can hope for, and actually it is the best, is neo-endogenous rural development, where you have not only people within an area coming up with their ideas and their innovations and ideas and knowledge about their area, but you're getting that articulated with the top down. The bottom up and the top down articulated is what neo-endogenous rural development is about. So it's a horrible phrase, but quite a simple idea, really. But the question is how to do it. And that's really what I've been trying to work towards here. So what we're looking for is not integrated rural development in that old sense of, you know, the pipelines and the silos and the money coming down and the local authority sorting it all out at the local level. We're now looking at something which is much more complex, many different parties involved at different levels, and this key challenge on the one hand of how to mobilise at the local level so people come together and develop a strategy for the future and work towards it, but at the same time a sort of vertical challenge of how that process at the local level articulates with government and other players at higher levels, like research institutes and universities, as well as government. A core element, both in this spatial planning, collaborative planning idea, and in the idea of neo-endogenous rural development that I've just sketched out, as exemplified by LEADER, I suppose, is capacity building. And I said I'd come back to that as a core concept here. If you're talking about generative power by the state, trying to build the power of people and places to look to their own future, you have to think how to build the capacity to do that, and how to build the capacity of everybody in that community to do that. In Patsy Healy's work, mainly in urban contexts, it has to be said, she's given quite a lot of thought to this and developed a model which suggests there are three main elements to the capacity of places. And she's shown in Inner City Newcastle how communities are able to work with these three to build their future. And the three elements are knowledge resources, by which she means sort of intellectual capital, knowledge as you would understand it, relational resources, which are very much about interactions between people. You might call it social capital if you like, but it's essentially about trust and social understanding built through interaction. And it won't just be within the place, it will also be about the interactions with elsewhere, the sort of relational networks that I've spoken about. And the third key element, beyond the knowledge and the networks, is the ability to actually work together, mobilisation capabilities, the capacity to act collectively. And those are three core elements, not only of place shaping in an urban context, the key elements of capacity building in a rural context and of integrated rural development in whatever new meaning we're working towards here. Of course, capacity building has been a core concept of LEADER. LEADER, as I've said, initially an experiment in supposedly endogenous development, bottom-up, built on local action, local knowledge, local capacity to act. And as I've argued, actually, it's more complicated than that. Almost every evaluation says, well, you know, it's been very successful, but it wasn't really local empowerment because power was continued to be held at higher levels in terms of the business plans having to be approved in Brussels and nationally, in terms of the funding pipelines. All the managerial technologies I talked about earlier are in place in relation to LEADER as much as with everything else. But in terms of the sort of direction I've been sketching out for rural development in the future, it does do many of the right things. It does seek to mobilise actors, to develop strategic agendas, to think about their place, what it has, what it could be, and how to get there. It does try and bring in different stakeholders and different partners to try and achieve that. It does employ concepts of place shaping, as understood in this literature. But there are these unresolved issues of the vertical relations. That is, it's not truly bottom-up, and although that's generally now recognised, at least in research, it's not really an aspect which has been admitted in the policy itself. So, what I'm going to suggest is that LEADER has considerable potential for us to explore how to do neo-endogenous rural development, because LEADER is being applied in more than 20 countries across the European Union, each with very different governance structures, and LEADER somehow fits into each of those. It's still a pilot programme, and yet all the piloting that's being done actually fails to take advantage of this wonderful experimental design, which could be looking at how LEADER fits in these very different frameworks and manages these vertical relations. And that's one of the biggest questions that we face. Why isn't anybody asking that question and looking at LEADER projects across Europe? So my argument is that there's an opportunity to move beyond the original LEADER experiment to address the sorts of issues that I've been raising. And in particular, the discourse of LEADER could be recast in terms of a new experiment in finding ways of doing what I call disintegrated rural development. May sound rather worrying, but it's to try and distinguish what's happening now from that old understanding of integrated rural development that I've been using as a sort of straw model during this. In particular, it could address all the challenges that I've been talking about here. Neo-endogenous rural development, how the top-down meets the bottom-up. Multiscalar governance, how can vertical integration through all these different levels at which governance takes place be promoted? The supportive state, how to adopt an enabling, fostering role which welcomes unexpected emergencies and innovations, even though they're not sort of in a plan anywhere. So how can the state be supportive of that sort of thing? The generative state, how to be a catalyst for local action, mobilising less powerful actors in particular and becoming itself an agent for change and supporting other agents for change. And the challenge, of course, of mainstreaming, going beyond the pilot aspect to mainstreaming these policies, where I think the example of Finland is very interesting in the way that LEADER local action groups have slotted into a structure there at a sub-regional level to allow village action groups to sort of operate in another tier of the multiscalar governance and to facilitate this meeting of the top-down and the bottom-up. I want to close by providing an illustration of one way of trying to work in this sort of direction. And this is taken from the report of the Committee of Inquiry on Crofting. And I'm not going to attempt to summarise the whole report. That would be another long talk, probably. But I do think that the recent report of the Crofting Inquiry has sought to address many of these issues. It might not have said so, but but certainly it has. What I won't go into any detail on is that it does seek to integrate many of the different departments of the Scottish Government, at least in terms of economic development policy, housing policy, agricultural and environmental policy, planning policy, and so on and so forth, in terms of making the managerial technologies work together rather than work against each other. And that is one of the main elements of the Crofting Inquiry report, because these managerial technologies are all there in terms of all those different parts of government, and the report tries to get them working together. But that's not the part that I'm going to speak about now. What I want to focus on just for the last few moments of my talk are the recommendations in relation to governance, because that's really what I've been talking about most of the time this afternoon. And the report of the Crofting Inquiry puts great store on trying to empower communities at various levels, not only at one level, but at a number of levels. There are proposals to have an elected set of local crofting boards in a federation of local crofting boards, which would take power closer to communities and give direct accountability to electorates. And that's the regulation aspect of crofting. One of the core ideas, if not the core idea, in the Crofting Inquiry report is to have grazings committees modernised or built on, if you like, to create township crofting development committees who prepare their own strategies for the future. They will be the locally based communities who are trying to place shape. They are trying to imagine their futures and work out collectively how to go forward towards that with the support of Scottish Government, Highlands Islands Enterprise and others. That's the generative power of the state and its agents and other partners trying to help that place shaping agenda be taken forward, while also, of course, protecting the broader public interest. You can see that capacity building and place shaping are core ideas in that report and its recommendations, and perhaps the best way of trying to illustrate it is with a diagram from the report. And on this diagram there are, actually I'm not sure if I've got a pointer, is that a pointer? I'm not sure how I work it, but sorry? Well, it probably is working now, I probably just don't know how to use it. Never mind, I don't need it really. This is best illustrated with a diagram, as I've said, and I will direct you around it as if I was sort of directing someone with an arrow, you know, left a bit, right a bit and all that. On the left side here, regulation, on the right hand side, development. What we're proposing in the Crofting Inquiry report is that the Scottish Government sets the national policy in the legislative framework quite properly, and that will protect the public interest to a large extent, that it gives the power to actually regulate in each area to a local crofting board, part of a federation of local crofting boards, that these are elected, they're responsible for regulation and enforcement, they're responsible for developing local crofting policies on regulation and applying those, and various other things. And they will have, anybody through this process will have a right of appeal to the Land Court as now. Now that in itself will build some capacity at the level of, say, the Western Isles or Shetland, but that's not the key point in terms of building capacity. The capacity building argument is much more important on the development side, because this is how we're trying to build the future of communities. And there on the right-hand side of this diagram, you see the Township Development Committees as the key organisations. Again, elected, based on grazings committees where those exist, or new if there aren't any grazings committees, and their purpose being to develop community strategies for the future of crofting. Now, how is that to be supported and how is that to be incentivised? Well, the support will come from the Crofting and Community Development Body, ideally a part of HIE based on its strengthening communities element and the community land unit and so on. People who have the skills of working with communities to help them imagine their own futures and go forward. So that's the support, and of course from local authorities and others. The incentive for people to come together and to allow them and enable them and encourage them to have that capacity built at the local level is that if they do develop these strategies in a way which is inclusive and is seen as being so, then the regulatory decisions will have to take account of those. They will make these strategies, and the regulatory decisions for that particular place will have to take account of those. So there's an incentive there and there's the support there. And it's our hope that that will help to build the capacity of communities throughout the crofting counties to work towards their future in the sort of way that I've been describing in this talk, and which hopefully you now have a better idea of. In conclusion then, how can the Scottish Government pursue a more integrated approach? Well, the first thing to say is not through old-style integrated rural development, in inverted commas, coordinating state programmes through local authorities. I'm not saying local authorities aren't important players. They should certainly be involved, but they can't be the only thing now. Instead, I'm trying to suggest and hold out hope of disintegrated rural development, by which I mean the state exercising generative power, building the capacity of communities, trying to stimulate action, innovation, struggle and resistance, and to essentially to release potentialities. And the key task of that is the mobilisation of people to develop strategies. That's the critical challenge. LEADER, I've suggested, offers a potential way of piloting ways of addressing these issues in practice, building capacity to act, experimenting with models for vertical integration and multi-scale governance. The Crofting Inquiry's report, I've suggested, illustrates one way of trying to action this approach. And final point, such an approach must be integrative, both vertically and horizontally, and trying to harmonise all these different managerial technologies, as I've said, while nevertheless being disintegrated in the sense that power is given up to local actors and the unexpected is embraced, far from earlier ideas of integrated rural development. Thank you very much.
Is this switched on?
It is, right, so you can hear. Well, thank you very much, Mark. You never seem to surprise. You always come up with something new, and that's always to be expected. Being rather mischievous, I, of course, in the world of acronyms, we look for something, and neo-endogenous rural development comes out as NERD, but... But at least we'll now remember it. But I think that was very interesting, and I'm sure there'll be lots of questions here now for Mark. So we have got roving microphones. We have got Jenna and Carol are the microphone girls. So please attract their attention and ask a question. So have we got a starter? Who's going to be first? Here we have Jeff Maxwell up here. Look at that. One microphone.
Well, thank you, Mark. I found that extremely interesting and very informative. And I think in terms of the ideas and the way in which you've analysed the concepts, it's been extremely helpful. And indeed, to an extent, explains why you've arrived at the position that you have with the Crofting Inquiry. What I'd like actually just to ask you, though, since you illustrated those ideas through the Crofting Inquiry, what is less explicit in terms of perhaps the solution, although you've mentioned them, is how you resolve some of the elements, if you like, of the vertical relationships, and in particular the role of the local authority, which is not certainly explicit in terms of the Croft and Cryer report, and I think that's quite important. If you could explain why it isn't perhaps as explicit as it might have been. The other thing that I would ask you about is the relationship on the one hand of development and the regulatory mechanisms that you have dealt with in some detail in the report. One of the objectives one would like to have seen perhaps in terms of the theory that you've explained to us today is that the regulatory mechanisms are driven, if you like, by the developmental objectives. To an extent, I think the inquiry has been caught out in the sense that it has had to determine some regulatory mechanisms without necessarily having the benefit of, if you like, the development concepts that might arise from the township idea that you've described. Perhaps you'd like to comment on just those two aspects, the local authority and the relationship between development and regulation.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm I don't want to go into great detail into the crofting report, because that's an illustration of what was, as you say, a more theoretical approach. In terms of the local authority in the crofting report, local authorities are key players, but they're extraordinarily different in relation to the different crofting areas. In some places you have an island authority which might be coterminous with the sort of area we're proposing for a local crofting board. In other areas, like the Highland Authority, it covers a vast area, which would probably cover lots of different areas. In other areas, most of Argyll and Bute, North Ayrshire perhaps, I don't know, there are areas where crofting part might be only part of the area. So it's very, very difficult to sort of deal with those different geographies and build them into a general model in an explicit way. I think what one has to say is that the local authorities would be key players, that it's very important that the regulatory body and the development institutions, whatever those prove to be in the end, articulate well with the local authority. And it may well be, we don't know how it will go, it may well be that local authorities rather than Highlands Islands Enterprise end up with the economic development function in the Highlands Islands. We're a committee of inquiry, we don't know what's going to happen, in which case there'd be a very different relationship. And clearly in relation to planning, there's another key point there. Are these crofting development plans going to feed into the local development frameworks, the local plans? And how is that going to happen? We haven't gone into that detail. We've said it's important that they do. And there's a matter of sort of focus, because we could have covered everything in our report. So it's a question of what are the important things and what are the things where we can say, well, it's important that that happens, but somebody else can work that out. In relation to the role between regulation and development, the key thing here is that both are accountable, both are elected, if you like. There are different levels, because I think, and we think, that development has to be undertaken at the lowest possible level. I mean, as they say in Finland, the basic unit of innovation is the coffee table. You have to get as low down as you can. But there was a very strong feeling amongst the people that we met, and we met, 2,500 people during our inquiry, or heard from them, there was a very strong feeling that regulation couldn't be taken that low, because it would be, with people falling out with one another and divisive within communities and so on. So they're at different levels, but we've tried to build this articulation between them in that mechanism of the development plans from the development from the crofting development committees having to be a material consideration in the regulatory decisions which are made.
Mark, thanks very much indeed. Again, a very stimulating lecture. The question I'd like to ask you is, you idealised LEADER to a considerable degree, and you saw, or see, I think, in crofting a model of the kind of way forward that you'd like to go. In some research that was conducted here 6 or 7 years ago, looking at common property and crofting and so on, it was clear, A, that a lot of crofting areas were almost moribund and lacked any real vitality. Mm-hmm. It was also clear from the work we did on that study that there were quite often significant tensions between the crofting community and the non-crofting community in those same physical spaces. Mm. And I just wonder what the relationship can be in your new future when your crofting is isolated from the rest of the spatial community in which those crofters are. Mm-hmm. And if I can take that issue of space on...
It's not in our...
Okay, well, okay, you can explain that to us. Mm-hmm. If I can take that issue on of space and the other element you idealised, LEADER, it would be that 90,000 people constitute the LEADER lag in Aberdeenshire today. And that includes people from the north coast of Aberdeenshire right to Braemar. I suspect they don't actually conceive of themselves as a common community, and that there are communities in Donside, individual communities in Donside, where the kind of dynamics and regenerative communities you want can be found at individual community level. And I suspect that leaders actually been stolen from those local communities, sometimes to a degree by local authorities that exercise, and local enterprise companies that exercise quite a degree of control over it. How do you create the right dynamics and the right levels to create that integration at the appropriate level that you want, and do the examples that you've offered actually afford the opportunities that you've suggested?
Okay, thanks, Bill. Let me deal with the second part first, and if I forget the first part, you'll have to remind me in going through it. But I haven't idealised leader. I've said what I think is valuable and interesting about leader, but I've also talked about the big flaw in leader, which is exactly the one you're asking about, which is about the vertical relationships. And those have not been thought through, and they're not even being analysed and learned from, and yet there is the scope to do that. To answer the particular question about Aberdeenshire and this huge lag there, if one was wanting to answer that question in the spirit of what I've been suggesting, you would be looking at how lags work in other countries and different governance structures, and you might find some countries where lags are very small, where indeed they are this sort of local community bottom-up development. But if you looked at the case that I mentioned of Finland, you might find, you might decide that that was very apposite, because in Finland the lag is at the sort of level that, that you've described in Aberdeenshire, but it's not pretending to be the bottom unit, the local community development body. Those are the villages. There is the Village Action Network in Finland, and you know that would exactly provide what you're looking for. So, I mean, I think that is an illustration of why what I'm suggesting, which is to look at the problem of the vertical integration, why it would be valuable for leader, and why it would be valuable if leader did it for more general learning about how to do neo-endogenous rural development. In terms of the crofting, if I remember your question correctly, we've recommended that the township development committees preparing these local strategies would be the community of place, not just crofters. So everybody in that community would have a vote in choosing those people. We've said that a majority of the committee should be crofters, but they will represent the community of place, and it will be a core task to think through the future of that place, the place shaping, and the role of crofting within that, along with other things. So I think it's very much in the spirit that you're asking about.
Got a question up at the back.
It was a fairly similar question to Bill's. It's really about how much can you rely on endogenous activity, because, you know, in my experience, some grazing committees are very active and others are moribund. And will this sort of system allow some to race ahead and others to get left behind?
I think that's a really important question. And to a large extent, in what we've seen in going around, is that some grazing committees are already doing what I've described here. So how do you support the others? How do you go to the areas where there aren't grazing committees at all and try and build this place-shaping approach, which is the basis of building the capacity to act and a sustainable future for those communities? And that's where, on the one hand, the support of community development agents through High or whoever it happens to be that's responsible for economic development and social development in the Highlands and Islands. And but that's not enough. You also need an incentive for people to come together and do that. Now, you and I know that the best incentive there is for people to come together in a community to actually do something collectively is a threat. Take away the village school. Threaten the bus service. I was told by community development workers in Easterhouse that in Glasgow that they used to get Glasgow City Council to say they were going to take something away so that people would come together, and then they could withdraw the threat, and people were really enthused because they'd had a success, and it was all part of the community development approach. So that was very exciting. Now, what would happen in our model is that if Say the people of Tyree, for example, didn't come together and develop a strategy for Tyree, what they would find would be that the Argyll and Bute, or whatever area it is, local crofting board, would be making the decisions about assignations and decrofting in their area in ways they might not like. And that would be a powerful incentive for them to actually get together, go through the process of thinking about their future. And you know, it's a well-established process. There's a lot of knowledge and expertise in how to support that. And there you have the beginnings of it. And then you've got to build that up. You've got to work with you know, skilled community development agents putting the support in. So that's the hope. We'll see whether it works.
We have a question down there, Alan.
Thank you very much. From my 20 years of working in Aberdeenshire in the North East, the only definition of a croft I can remember is an area of land surrounded by a sea of legislation.
Mm. We use that in the report. Actually.
Good, I'm very pleased to hear it. I don't particularly think there's much tension between what you're suggesting in crofting areas versus other areas, because in a sense, all councils, all communities want to have their voice heard, and want to have it heard and acted on if at all possible. Outside the crofting areas, in looking ahead, certainly Aberdeenshire has taken the notion of looking at using the imagination, not say getting to decisions, but looking 20 years ahead, saying what direction should this community grow? Mm-hmm. It's the same with crofting, mm-hmm. and you need to take that into account. The other feature you need to just remember is that there's a new act coming in, planning act coming in, having been passed by the Scottish Parliament. The commitment was that there would be much more consultation at the front end of the process as a price to pay for no third-party rights of appeal. That's a serious statement and needs to be taken into account.
Yeah. Thanks, Alan. I mean, my understanding is that the direction in which planning guidance is moving in Scotland is very much towards this place-shaping agenda. And you're right, what I've said is a more general applicability. The crofting was an illustration of it. And I think, you know, one of the tasks of development is to think about what's general, and I've tried really to concentrate on that today, and what's specific to a particular place in that situation, and that's where the crofting illustration comes in.
I have a question here. Forward, there you are.
Thanks very much, Ken Thompson. Two-pronged, if I can. Mark, could you give us a few words about how you see the current situation of LEADER within the Scottish Rural Development Programme, which after all is a major funding stream to get under pipelines, and actually most of which is agri-environmental payments, which I'm not sure is development or regulation or a third pipeline. Mm. My second prong is we seem to be jumping from the Western Isles to somewhere in Aberdeenshire, and I can think of a large rural development project coming up in Aberdeenshire next week, which may or may not be a good example for your advice. Looking for neutral ground, what about the National Park? You did mention that. Is that too large for your thinking, or have the National Park authorities worked in a way which you would approve of?
Well, difficult questions as usual, Ken. I mean, on the latter one, I haven't really looked at national parks in Scotland. I know there's an inquiry just beginning. But I would hope that the sort of approach and structures that I've talked about, being a multi-level, multi-scale governance approach, you would be able to apply to an area of that sort of scale of a national park. But, you know, you'd have to think about within that and without it, you know, what are the different levels at which things need to happen. So, you know, you might be working with the people of Braemar to produce a Braemar community plan I'm trying to think what the word... Community plan, you see, has been taken away. It's been stolen as a meaning, but you know what I mean. Small c, small p. Within a framework of the national park, which somehow fits within the framework of national planning in Scotland. So I think that would be the answer to that one. Yes, the first point, LEADER in the SRDP. Again, I haven't looked closely at that. I've been sort of caught up in LEADER in England, being on the selection committee and all that, and so it tends to drive out the, you know, the Scottish model. But the OECD report does I think, I don't know if lament is too strong a word, the fact that LEADER wasn't made more fundamental to the delivery of the SRDP, and it describes as rather surprising, if you like, the dominance of the agro-environmental element of the SRDP. But that I understand that that was just at the time of the change of government, and there were all sorts of reasons for that.
Question here.
Yeah, thanks. Hamish Trench from the Cairngorms National Park Authority. Funnily enough, I was about to turn to national parks as well, actually, because as a different example to crofting, it struck me that the model you described is very much a description of the model of Scottish national parks. And one of the tensions sort of within national parks and underlying that model is between the local and national interest. Mm. And implicit in what you were saying there was really the sort of maybe an assumption that that tension can be a healthy tension between local and national interests. Mm-hmm. I just wondered if you could say a bit more about whether you see that be as something that should be resolved at a local level, or to what extent you see government having a role in resolving that tension at the top level.
Mm. I think one of the key questions is, you know, how to bring together the national and indeed international interests in a place like the Cairngorms and the local interests. And there are different models to try and do that. One is to have board members who are elected locally alongside board members that are nominated by the ministers, and that's very much what happens in the English national parks. There's a question of how many there should be, which I understand is on the agenda in Scotland. But there might be other ways of doing it as well. I mean, another way of doing it would be for national government to set very clear parameters, you know, all these managerial technologies, and then leave it to local decision makers. I mean, that's how national and local interests are reconciled everywhere else. So I think there would be different models, and I'm sure that's one of the things that this inquiry going on at the moment will be looking at.
Brian, at the back there.
Yeah, Brian Clark. Mark, again, I enjoyed it and found it very stimulating, but one expression that you used slightly troubled me, which was government decides on policy when you were looking at your diagram. And it seems to me the kind of case that you were making this afternoon was very much one in which the kind of grassroots bottom-up effect has got to be taken through into the process. Politicians, thank God, come and go. Civil servants come and go. And this seems to me so fundamentally important that what the people who are experiencing the problems, the difficulties, need to be saying in formulating the policy made me slightly nervous about your statement about the policies decided, quote, at the top-down level.
I think what I said, or I hoped I said, was that national policy should be decided by the Scottish Government and local policy would be decided by local crofting boards. And more generally, the issue is, you know, what are the legitimate national or international interests which have to be looked at and brought to bear on decisions, and what are the things which can be left for local decision making? And you can look at various examples of this. So in relation to crofting, there might be a national decision and a national policy that crofting is going to survive and that there is going to be security of tenure for crofters. But there might be much more local decisions about, for example, the priority to be given to young people and new entrants in access to vacant crofts, and in how to develop crofting and, you know, promote cooperation or whatever it is. Another example in relation to housing, and this is much more of maybe an English illustration than a Scottish one, but if you left the housing policy to local communities in rural England, most of them wouldn't allow any. And yet, clearly, you know, if you're looking at sustainable rural communities and you're looking at the need, the crying needs of people for affordable rural housing, you need to have some. Or in relation to homelessness, national policy will require homeless people's needs to be met. Most local communities will say, well, not here, thank you. So you've got to have that national and international interest built in somewhere. But it's the balance and the articulation between the two.
Two over here, and then that's I think you're working quite hard, aren't you? You're right.
I'm happy to go on. I've almost time.
John Milne speaking. Mark, you talked about defined place as a social construct. Most of the conversation we seem to have had has been about place in a geographical sense. Can you give some ideas about where one could think of place as a social construct in rural development in, for example, Scotland?
Mm. I suppose there are many ways in which what is the place you belong to is constructed. I mean, during my time here, I lived in Grampian, which doesn't exist anymore, I don't think, except maybe in some institutional structures. I lived in Aberdeenshire, I lived in Gordon, I lived in Kincardine and Deeside. So, you know, what is the place that you live in? There's the question of, you know, administratively how it's defined. There's the question of what it means in terms of identity and belonging and in terms of sort of networks and communities and interactions. If you wanted some examples, I remember a letter some years ago in the Donside Piper, and I forget, maybe it's best if I don't mention which particular villages they were anyway, but there was a letter from somebody in one of the villages in Strathdon lamenting the fact that incomers were moving in and that it was, you know, changing the place. And the next week there was a letter in the Donside Piper saying, "Who's that to talk? You're from a village 2 miles away. You're an incomer." So, you know, what it means is very much what you yourself mean, how you construct it. Some people would think, you know, that they were both from the same place. Those two people clearly had different views. So that's the sense in which I mean socially constructed. Now, the idea of place shaping requires some collective view to be taken. And part of the negotiation process and the coming together process is to work out, you know, what you imagine to be the place in your mind and how that translates into who's part of it in decision-making terms. I don't know if that answers your question, but it gives you some illustrations of what I'm talking about.
Got one last question from the floor.
Martin Orr from RSPB. There are other bodies at a local level, some of which have interests that are community of place and community of interest. I wonder how you see community councils that are in some places very dynamic, in some places rather moribund, playing a part in what you propose.
Mm. Well, that's an interesting one, because again, community councils have a very sort of uneven coverage, some very active and other areas where there aren't any at all. And I know there has been research done trying to look at, you know, how many are active and what they're doing. We felt that we couldn't build on community councils again as a sort of central ingredient because of that variety and unevenness, but also because we felt that the more local level of the grazings committee was in the township was more the area that people would relate to themselves, even if we might hope that they come together to work in rather larger areas. But I think the community council would be another one of the stakeholders. I mean, I've been asked the same question about landowners, you know, what part would they play in this? And I think it's up to the people themselves in a place to think about who are the actors in the process, if you like, and if there was a vibrant community council, in the same way as if there was a landowner who was, you know, willing to work with them, it would be extraordinary if they were not involved in that process.
Well, thank you very much. If I can take the privilege, I would like to ask the last question. My recent experience in planning has actually rather been with aquaculture and trying to get aquaculture on the planning agenda. And I suspect that aquaculture, like crofting, invokes fairly strong emotions. I wonder how you would persuade people, government and local level, to relinquish their power so that you could enable your model to work. And then how you think that smaller model might get the skills it would need, particularly in the conflict resolution that might occur, and undoubtedly in certain areas does occur, and also at the technical level.
Which powers are you thinking about? Are you thinking about people opposing planning applications? Or are you thinking about owners of property rights?
I'm trying to think within your place, getting the consensus and getting the agreement. And of course, the local authorities hang on to their power very strongly, and they take that right very seriously. Yeah. And you've got to persuade them somehow that they're going to enfranchise a smaller unit.
That's a really incisive question, insofar as the power relations are absolutely fundamental to the whole thing, and yet usually they're not paid attention to in any of the thinking about these things. There's a sort of fantasy that everybody is equal in the process, on partnerships and in committees and so on. It seems to me that the way of dealing with that is for the community development workers, or the people who are supporting this process, to not only think about building the capacity of that place, but also about who within that place it is that they're building the capacity of, so that they're paying attention both to building the collective capacity, but also to building the capacity, the power to, of the most powerless people within that community. Now, you know, there are limits to that. Obviously, if the local authority is holding most of the resources, you know, then as we've seen in much of the experience of LEADER, you know, they can provide the match funding, so everybody has to do what they want. So you know, there are, it is a real world that we live in. There are power relationships, but I think having that responsibility on the agents to do that, and having a requirement that the strategies that are produced will only be taken on board by planning authorities, local crofting boards, whatever, if it can be shown that they have been truly inclusive, then, you know, there are the two elements to that. But it's not a perfect world. We'll not overturn inequalities of power through this, but we should.
So ultimately, would you see it coming from a power of direction, actually, of central government, perhaps even to say, you will let this lot get on with it?
In certain cases, yes. But I think also, you know, through building capacity of people without power, that will help too.
Well, thank you very much. From my personal point, that's a good point to end on. I'm well aware that there are more questions here. You've obviously, you know, generated a huge amount of interest in here, and I suspect that you will go on to be questioned for a long time to come out there. Now, before you go any further, there is something I will probably forget to say at the end, so I'll say it right now. When we've finished, there are ice cream cones in the marquee. And on pain of death was I to forget that, otherwise there will be a rather gooey mess. So remember your ice cream cones. Now, I am standing between you and your ice cream, so I'm aware of that. But Mark, I please come up, you haven't finished yet, because I have to give you the Macaulay scroll, which is your prize for delivering the lecture. But you did work extremely hard, and so we do have the Macaulay quake.
Oh,
now, I hope you remember last night with the piper, the instructions for usage. Now, I'm sure that somewhere along the line you'll manage to find something to fill it with. So thank you very, very much for the lecture, and thank you for stimulating everybody here.
Thank you, and thanks for inviting me.
Now, it's of course traditional at this point that I thank the guests for coming far and wide to listen to the Macaulay lecture. And indeed, I do thank you very much for coming from far and wide to listen to the lecture. It's very important to us that you do come and see what's happening at the Macaulay. But on behalf of the board, I think it's very important that pay tribute to the staff, the people that work here. It's actually the work at the Macaulay that's really exciting, and that's only done if we have dedicated and committed people working here. And I think those of you who have been here over the last couple of days have seen that demonstrated in the marquee or all over the place in the building, and indeed in a fortnight's time we'll be down at the Highland Show. So thank you very much to everybody who works here. It is really appreciated, and especially at a time when we're being asked to consider the future of the Macaulay and how what that might look like over the next few years. And I just have to tell you that standing here, I well acknowledge the work you do and the role we have in looking after the staff that work here, and it will be foremost in the consideration of the board, that I can assure you. But also, this day would not happen if it weren't for a number of people. And of course, right at the very top, we have to thank Chief Executive Richard Aspinall for making it all happen. It's him who directs the work, it's him who keeps the show on the road on a daily basis. So Richard, thank you very much for your helmsmanship of the Institute over the past year. It was mentioned, and Richard did already thank the technical department, but I've been very conscious that this place has resembled a battlefield over the last 3 years. 3 months. 3 months. And really, you see the grass sprouting now, thanks to the good weather. Well, it's not very long ago that was a complete ploughed patch. I'm also very conscious that we're very thankful we've got dry weather, because underneath that very, very smart floor in the marquee is a sea of mud. So we didn't really want our guests to disappear into it, so a lot of people have been praying for good weather. And the responsibility for all this really falls on one person. And again, she's got, in a fortnight's time, the Highland Show. And I think it's a measure of the detail that she goes into that with all that in place, last night, she still actually managed to send me a birthday cake to a dinner. So, Jane, please, would you come up here and get a bunch of flowers? Silly girl. So thank you very much to Jane, because this really is her show, and it's amazing the amount of work. But again, can I re-emphasise the work that Graham and his team have done to make the grounds look respectable for you today. So thank you very much to all those. Now, I'm well aware that there are lots and lots of other people that have made lots of things happen, and I hope that Richard's covered them off, but it is appreciated what you do. So thank you very much for coming. And the ice cream cones are in the marquee.